Okay, hi. I'm not on. Turn yourself on, Larry. There we go. How's that? Better? I'm sorry for the quality of my speech today. I've had a relapse in the sinuses, and yeah, I'm feeling a little not resonant as I usually am, but I'll try to project. Okay. We'll see. Couple of questions. We're going to have some informal discussion review sessions. If you'd like them, I'll put those up on the web probably Friday this week. And next week late. And for those, you can bring your papers or your questions, anything you would like. They won't be formal and they'll last only as long as people care to be there. Next Thursday or Friday, we'll have a formal review session or two in preparation for the ECO exam, which is a week from Monday here. So let me get an idea of whether you'd like to have a review session for that on Thursday or Friday, and what time of day. So, by show of hands, what your preferences are. Would you like one on Thursday morning, afternoon, early afternoon, late afternoon? Yeah, late Thursday. Friday? First part of the morning? 8 o'clock on Friday always kills them. 10 o'clock on Friday. Noon on Friday. 1 on Friday. 2 on Friday. 3 on Friday. Friday night. You can do that one. Okay. Okay, I didn't see much for Friday that made any sense, so we'll pick something and see if you show up. How many of you would like one over the weekend before the ECO exam, Saturday or Sunday? Sunday? Sunday night, so you can cram. Okay, how many of you would like one Sunday afternoon? Sunday evening. Okay, one of the late afternoon Sunday. Okay, we'll pick something. I'll be one on Sunday. I have to look at my calendar and see when my wife can live without me. We'll see. Okay, other questions, or we will put those on the web. We'll put those on the web, and we'll also announce them in class next week. The informal one or two Friday this week we'll put on the web probably tomorrow because we have to get a place for it. Okay. Do you want me to email it to you too? Does that help? Remind me to both email and the web. No, the ECO exam is a week from Monday. So after today we have two classes next week to finish up. And a week from today, in class, we will do review. So make sure that you've been through all the developology reading and see what questions you have, what isn't clear, and I'll see if I can confuse you even more on Wednesday. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Julie and Greg finished the exercise threes, so we'll give those back at the end of class today, 2:30. And they were generally quite good. I'm going to steal all your thunder. I'll leave you with nothing to say. Okay. But there were some consistent some issues that warrant being clarified. And you'd like better lighting? And more light. Okay. The issues that Julie and Greg identified in looking at the exercises were, first, the exercise was about how settings can be linked. And it's very important in Bronfenbrenner and in thinking about developology to keep clear in your mind that a setting is a place. A setting is a definable physical place. It's not a hockey team. It's not your friends. It's not going out on Saturday night. It's the places where those things happen. Okay? So practice that. That a setting is always a physical place. Those friends and the hockey team and the practices may be part of the microsystem that happens in the setting. But it's not the setting itself. And it's important in Bronfenbrenner to keep those clear because you want to be able to define the physical characteristics of the setting itself, and then connected to that but separate, you want to be able to describe the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities that happen in that setting. And that becomes important when you think about comparing settings. You want to be able to compare them physically, and you want to be able to compare and contrast the microsystems that may happen in those settings. Every setting that has people in it has a microsystem in it, and those microsystems are always unique. They may be similar to each other. They may have some of the same activities going on in them. They may be compatible with each other. And it's important to be able to talk about those compatibilities. And we'll come back to that one. The exercise asks that you think about how and describe how settings are linked. And the links for our purposes are not the sidewalks or the highways between them or the train tracks or the airplane. The links are the communication or the people or the intersetting knowledge to look at an indirect link. So when you're describing the links, think about the social links, not specifically the physical links. It's okay to talk about the highways or the byways or the railroads or the fact that one setting that's important to you may be upstairs from another one that's important to you downstairs. Those relationships, the physical layout of the various settings in your message system might be important to how far removed they are from each other, but those are not the links themselves. The links are people for the primary and supplemental links. They're people if settings are connected by another person as an intermediate link. And links are communication or knowledge. So it's actually a very limited set of links, different ways that settings can be linked to each other. Some people describe the common themes, which is actually describing the similarities between the microsystems into settings. But that's not the same as the links. The links are how those settings are connected socially. The comparison of them is a separate question. A number of people in looking at Hypothesis 28 talked about the settings but didn't actually talk about the compatibility of the role demands. And the compatibility of the role demands refers to how much potential conflict or how much support there is of the roles in each of the settings. And the hypothesis refers to having compatible role demands being good for your development. Having one setting help you carry out the roles that you have in another setting. Or reinforcing that role. Incompatibility is when your role in one setting interferes with carrying out the role in the other setting. So an example I used was the restaurant telling you if you don't show up for lunch, even if you have an exam, you lose your job. That's incompatible. Okay? Hypothesis 34 is subtly different from 33, I think, or whichever one it is. It looks almost identical. The difference is that the earlier one refers to the developing person, and 34 refers to the supplemental links. So the other people who are in the transcontextual dyads, people who are also links between the settings, but what he's doing is reinforcing the notion that if everybody is involved in primary dyadic relationships and joint activities and mutual trust and goal consensus and all of those wonderful things, if the developing person is involved in that and these settings both support the developing person, and then if those settings also support the supplemental person, and the supplemental person is engaged in those same good activities, then you have a really richly supportive network. So it's one of those examples where reading the hypotheses very carefully and comparing them carefully becomes important, because Bronfenbrenner repeats himself over and over again with just varying one thing at a time to reinforce the idea. Okay, hypothesis 38, the problem that showed up there most commonly was misunderstanding the notion of indirect links. Indirect links come in three types: intersetting knowledge, intersetting communication, or an intermediate link, which is a person. And in that case, the settings that are linked, and this may have been where the confusion came in, I wasn't clear about how confusing that could be, so I'll try to straighten that out. In looking at the intermediate links, an intermediate link is a person who connects two settings. Okay. Now, those two settings would be in the intermediate link's mesosystem, because this person, is involved in both of those settings. But when we're focusing on the developing person, the reference person, the person who defines the mental system, that person isn't involved. So when we're talking about an intermediate link, we're talking about how this setting is linked to that setting. But these settings are not both in this person's mesosystem system, because the reference person doesn't go into that setting. That setting is not linked directly, so it's not in the mesosystem system. But it is linked to this person by this intermediate link. Another person goes there. And that's how this person might get in a setting knowledge. May learn about that setting through the intermediate link. But this setting A is in the reference person, the person we're focusing on, in that person's mesosystem, but this setting is actually in that person's exosystem, because it's a setting that might affect that person, but a setting in which the reference person doesn't go. So the intermediate link connects these settings, but these settings are not both in the developing person's mesosystem. And I'll try to make that clearer in the description of intermediate links in the next edition of the book. Okay? And then Julie and Greg were confused by some of your papers because you were talking about five different hypotheses, but when you were talking about different ones, you didn't identify which ones they were. And so if you don't identify which one you're talking about, they can't tell whether you understand the one that you think you're talking about, because they can't identify which one it is. So you could be terribly confused, and they might think that you understood the hypothesis, but you might in fact be referring to a hypothesis that you don't understand and confusing them. And when everybody's confused, you're all in the same boat and it's sinking. That's right. Don't worry about it. Okay? So those are what we learned. And I'll put that up on the web to remind me. Okay. And so I just streak on through the next few hypotheses about the mesosystem. We were in about the middle of that long list of hypotheses. And what Bronfenbrenner is doing, of course, is trying to tell us how the various settings that you participate in might be connected in ways that would help your development. Through supplemental links, through goal consensus, through mutual trust, and we'll continue in that theme. So, that's probably where I left off. The developmental potential is enhanced to the extent that the indirect linkages, the intermediate people, the communication, and the knowledge encourage positive feelings between those two settings. Okay. So, no surprises there. And if you're participating in two settings, that's likely to go better for you if there is communication between those settings. So if the people that you're interacting with in the two different settings can talk to each other face to face, that will be good for your development. For example, one of the things that daycare providers try to do is have a face-to-face conversation with every parent at the beginning of the day and the end of the day, because they're responsible in the child care setting. The provider is responsible for making the transition from home to the care setting as smooth as possible. And if there's something going on in the child's life, the provider has a responsibility to try to help the child deal with that appropriately, to understand what the child is trying to communicate. And as you know, sometimes toddlers don't communicate very clearly about what's going on in their lives because of articulation problems and grammar problems and understanding problems. So if you're going to have the childcare setting be maximally helpful to your child, you want that the person, the adult in that setting, to understand what's going on at home. And writing a short note is probably not the best way to do that. So you want the communication to be two-way. You want also for the child care provider to be able to talk to the parents, ideally face-to-face. And that should be easy. It's not. You know, parents are late to work. They run in. They drop a kid off. They neglect to say, well, we have three relatives visiting. There's a cat in the house that they brought with them. The kid's allergic to cats, and that's why she's sneezing, and we were all up late last night, and you know, whatever else you don't tell the child care provider gets in the way. Okay, so then the child care provider isn't able to help the child deal with it and may misinterpret the child's behavior. I think most of these are fairly self-explanatory. This one talks about the face-to-face communication being better than a note. Where does email fall? He wrote this before email was invented. So where would you put email in this list of priorities? The best communication is face-to-face because that way you have more information conveyed. Personal letter or note, phone, business letter, or announcement. If I send an email to the entire class, I guess that qualifies as an announcement. On the other hand, if it's an announcement, in the sense of putting something up or saying we will have a review session at 4 o'clock on Friday, which is an announcement, if there's something that isn't directed at you personally, you can ignore it. An email that comes into your personal inbox may fall farther up that line, and I just don't know where it is. You might think of the various techniques that are used to try to attract attention to emails and to make them more personal. Okay. That's kind of standard communication theory stuff. It helps if you have an understanding, some inner setting knowledge, before you go into a setting. That's why we have orientation. That's why we send you all that information before you enter school. You have some idea of what the system is, what the roles are, what the expectations are, what the activities are going to be. So generally, throwing people into a setting that they don't know anything about is potentially not as helpful because they spend a lot of time trying to figure out what's going on and they don't have any way to pre-rehearse or think about the way they want to behave or what they're going to get out of the setting that they're about to go into. So the more information you have about a setting, the more likely you are to be able to scope it out when you get there, figure it out, and figure out how to fit into it. So when people say things, if you've already read what they're about to say, it makes more sense to you. That can backfire, and that's a point that students have brought up before. You may know too much about a setting before you go into it. If you're getting your information from somebody whose view of the setting is not valid, or if that person's communication about the setting doesn't encourage mutual trust, then that information may work to your detriment as you move into that setting and find out that your friend was wrong. And I've already got egg on my face because I came into this setting with the wrong set of expectations because the information I got was invalid. It was based on my friend's or my former friend's experience, and that was not validly transferable to me. And it helps if the information that goes along with you and back to people in your other settings, both of those kinds of information, if that is valid and if it moves fairly easily. For example, one of the common things that happens in schools is that when kids transfer, elementary schools, parents move, kid shows up in a new school for fourth grade, there's no record for that child. And nobody has any idea what the child has studied or what the child is interested in or what kinds of activities are most highly motivating for the child. If that kind of information doesn't arrive pretty quickly, then the school has to go through all of the process of figuring out who this kid is and it makes it difficult for them to engage in appropriate activities with the child and meet the child where he or she is. You have to do your own assessment then. And if you had had a little more information about what had happened in the previous school, what the child did well and didn't do well, if you'd had that, you would have been able to tailor your activities in a way that would support the child's development more quickly. That's probably a common experience, one that's probably not too fatally problematic. But I'll give you one that's a little more difficult. An old friend of mine, acquaintance in the family, extended family, had a heart attack and was in the hospital. And she had made it extremely clear. They had made it clear she wasn't going to live very long. And she was also not going home. But they couldn't keep her in the hospital because she didn't need hospital care. So they transferred her to a nursing home. And the first day in the nursing home, her folder had not yet arrived. Her file had not yet arrived. There was no electronic communication. The transfer ambulance took her to the nursing home. They signed her in. Her family was with her. But somewhere along the way, the fact that she had made very clear instructions that she was not to be resuscitated, no code, that fact didn't get into her file. So the first day she was there, she had another heart attack. And because there was no information, the staff did what they thought they were supposed to do, which is resuscitate a 96-year-old woman. And when they resuscitated her, they did it successfully. She was royally pissed. She did not want to be there alive anymore because of the pain and what she experienced as indignity. And so it really colored the last 10 days of her life. She didn't want those 10 days. And the family was upset, too. But those sorts of things can happen. I'll give you another example that's probably even worse. I don't worry too much about 96-year-olds who are sharp enough after their second heart attack to tell you that they're really pissed at you and they didn't want to be here. What did you do that for? You're not supposed to do that. Okay, I have a little sympathy. But I have more sympathy for a 2-year-old who shows up in critical condition at a children's hospital, transferred from another hospital with an incomplete record. And because of the symptoms, is treated in the receiving hospital immediately because she had to be treated and died because the treatment was incorrect, because the file was incomplete and they didn't know why she was coming in and what they had done in the other hospital. And that one can really rip parents up and down. And had the file been complete, the 2-year-old probably would have been successfully treated and survived. But because the file was incomplete, she died. And the hospital got sued. And, of course, hospitals settled. But that doesn't help the 2-year-old or the parents very much. Okay? You can think about ways that you get valid information from setting to setting, and situations that you've been in. Think about if you've worked in a camp communicating about kids, if you think about going to spend a week with relatives, do they have information about you? Going to college, did you have what you needed in the way of information before you got here? Okay. This is a special instance. Bronfenbrenner is interested in those small groups of people that you may have in your life who occupy a variety of settings with you and go from setting to setting with you. And what he's suggesting is that we'll call it a closed activity network, And as I pointed out in the book, that's not a bad close. It's a good close. It's just a description. It's not really good or bad. It's just a description of the fact that you have a small group of people who travel from setting to setting together and engage in activities together over time. And he's going to call that a closed activity network, because if you draw in the meso system, and we'll say you've got A, B, C, and D in each of these settings, so you've got a series of transcontextual dyads. They're engaging in activities in each of those settings, and they go around the community together. They're best friends. In this case, A is mom, B is dad, C is Tommy, and D is Sally. And you've got family, which goes from place to place, activity to activity, together. And Bronfenbrenner says that any time that happens, you have increased potential for development. Whether it's 3 settings or 5 settings or 12 settings, it's going to be good for you. Why is it going to be good for you? Why is it going to be good for you? Right. Those 4 people are sharing experience. They can talk about that experience. They can compare the experience in different settings. So he's referring to the proximal processes, the engagement in each setting and in each relation. He's talking about what is likely to be learned from the experience, and suggesting that that's going to be most positive, you're going to learn the most if you're in settings with the same people, so that when you go from the first setting to the second, the same people are there and you can talk about what you did in the first setting. What that's doing is reinforcing the experience. It's allowing you to think it through. It's allowing you to ask questions. Particularly if you're a child, it's allowing the parents to ask you about the experience that you had, what you remember about the experience that you had, answer questions about the experience, point out similarities. So they're helping you make connections among your different experiences. And that is how, in a constructivist theory, you develop a more valid understanding of your experiences. Because you can compare and contrast them, you can rehearse them, you can elaborate on them, you can find better vocabulary for them, you can use them to deepen the relationships that you have, the positive affect in those relationships, and the reciprocity, because you've shared the experience. So the kid who wants to make contact with a parent who's reading can rely on the fact that they have that shared experience and ask the parent to tell the child about the experience that they had. Can ask a question about it. So it increases the reciprocity in the relationships, which is good. It gives more power to the child relative to the child who doesn't have that, because the child is able to engage the parent and describe his or her own experience and be able to do that because the parent has shared the experience with the child. And so you know the parent knows something about it and is going to help you understand it. So what Bronfenbrenner is doing is supporting the notion that the more activities we have with each other, the more we talk about those activities, the better, the more valid, the more differentiated the view we can have of the world that we've experienced. And the greater reciprocity there'll be in our relationships with other people who've shared those experiences. Other examples of that, I'd use the family. Where are your closed activity networks? Do you participate in them? Do you have people that you go from setting to setting with? No? Yes? Sure. Casey. Is what? Okay. You were wondering about Greeks?
Yeah.
Okay. The sorority? Fraternity? Do things in different settings together? Do your community service together? Serve on committees together? Go to classes together? Is that good for you? Probably, if Bronfenbrenner's right. Those best friends in elementary school, that's one of the ways that you create those bonds, is to share activities with them. Other examples? Any of you hang out with people you went to boarding school with? Or high school with? Roommate from high school. So over time, you have that small closed activity network. It doesn't mean that all of your relationships and all of your settings have to be connected. It just means that those that are, those that you share with other people over a number of settings, which is going to mean over time, are going to be better for your development. If you constantly are encountering new people and entering new settings without anybody that you have any connection with, any relationship with, you're not going to be able to talk about those experiences as well as you can or as deeply as you can with somebody who's actually shared them with you. Which is why it's so hard to talk about some of the experiences that are most important to us, because we're not with people who share them. In my family systems course last week, one student wrote, "To understand my family, you have to be part of it." And that's an interesting example. The family, in her case, is a closed activity network for some things, and they have shared unique experiences. They've developed ways of interacting that other people don't share in. And it's her view that you really can't get a valid view of her family unless you have been in that closed activity network for a while to see how it really works. Okay. Another piece for your mesosystem is that you'd like for your kid to be involved in responsible tasks, things with goals, work, preferably with other adults. So he's arguing against the closed activity network of the family. Well, he's saying it needs to be balanced. You need to have settings open to you as a child that get you involved with other adults. And those settings, if they're going to be helpful, should involve you in activities and should give your child an opportunity to move beyond the comfort of the family and whatever dysfunctional patterns have developed there and have a chance to experience other adults, other families. To engage in relations and join activities with people who aren't as familiar, but who may become familiar because of your involvement with them. My father knew that. That's why he always made sure I had a job. Responsible, task-oriented, adults other than my family. And the rule was when I was working and making an income, he didn't have to pay my allowance. He probably couple of motives there. On the other hand, I had my own money. And if I had my own money from working, then I could spend it how I wanted to. Okay, what happens? You've got a mental system. You've got all those settings that you go into. And if there are a number of them that you're going into over time, what happens over a long period of time across those settings becomes important. And Bronson Brenner introduces the notion of a developmental trajectory. Which is a way of thinking about the settings that you participate in over a long period of time. And I'm drawing these double like this to suggest that at any point in time you may be engaged in a couple of different settings that are all connected by you, because you're the primary link, so they are mesosystem settings over time. And on the left, I've started you, and maybe it's daycare, maybe it's a nursery school, maybe it's a preschool setting, maybe it's a playgroup. And over time, what you're doing is entering a sequence of new settings. And maybe not going back to the old one. So you have a moving picture here that takes you through a sequence of settings over time. And you leave them behind as you pass on. And this only represents a small selection of the mesosystem settings that you might participate in. But these are all linked. And they're all linked, not just by you as the primary link, the person who goes into all of them, but they're linked because some kind of activity goes with you across the settings, across time. Some kind of activity. And as it goes on, it becomes a molar activity, and it becomes more complex. And Bronson Brenner is using the notion of a molar activity here in a helpful way, because he's saying that the momentum, remember, molar activity has a momentum of its own, intrinsic to it. The momentum does two things within the notion of developmental trajectory. The first is the momentum of the activity means that when you enter a new setting, you're likely to continue that activity. And the second way he's using momentum is that as you engage in that activity, you look for new settings in which to carry out that activity. So it has momentum in the sense that it moves you to be attracted to some settings rather than others. So in this case, we choose not to go into this setting because it doesn't support that particular activity that we're engaged in. So the notion of a developmental trajectory is that the mesosystem that we participate in over time is constantly changing as we leave settings behind in our childhood and enter new settings as we get older. But some of those settings create and maintain and support a particular kind of activity. Horseback riding, dancing, soccer, doing math, becoming a doctor, becoming a heroin addict, being a juvenile delinquent, being a child abuser. All of those are activities that can become more complex, and all of them are potentially describable in terms of the sequence of settings that contributed to them. But developmentally now, we're really getting to the heart of Bronfenbrenner's analysis of the lifespan. If there is any structure or consistency in your life, if anything becomes important to you over time, we can describe it by referring to the sequence of settings that have created and supported and maintained and elaborated that particular activity. Okay? It's a straightforward notion, but it's now a way of saying that settings are linked over time, and think back to the term goal consensus. That may be across time, that the goal consensus is to turn you into a ballet dancer and to improve your skills, to make you the best soccer player around. And you're not going to be that in preschool, but if your preschool supports soccer and your home supports soccer and people take you to soccer games, and you can go through the rest of that analysis yourself, what you have is goal consensus, not necessarily deliberate, but based on what your interests are. And the choice of settings to go into based on the fact that they will support that activity. So if you're developing a trajectory that is based on soccer, then probably you're not going to go out to the swim team. And so you decide not to go into a setting that isn't conducive to playing soccer. I'm making the assumption that swimming and soccer are in the same season, and you can't not being a soccer player. I don't know whether they are or not, but still with me. Okay. The point is that the choice of the development of a trajectory affects the choice of settings. It makes some of them more important for you to go to. It makes others less. Think about the soccer players here on scholarship. They had their choice of colleges, and they didn't choose the ones that don't play soccer, or the ones that didn't offer them scholarships. So the notion of developmental trajectory is a way of linking the settings and talking about how it is that we develop complex motives and habits and patterns of behavior and eventually structure, including careers, in our lives. And if you have a set of settings over time that support a trajectory, those are probably the ones that you think are important in your life, and Bronfenbrenner is going to call those primary settings. Yeah. So the ones, out of all the possibilities of the ones that you're engaged in, the ones that support the trajectories that are important to you, he's going to call primary settings. So if you think about where you really studied ballet, or where you really played soccer, where you really learned soccer, got the coaching, or got the coaching in dance, whatever it is that you're pursuing, where did that happen? What were the most important settings for keeping that trajectory going? Those are the primary settings in your life. And as I pointed out in the text, one of the wonderful things about Bronfenbrenner is that it applies to any career, any long-lasting interest or activity that you engage in, whether it's bowling or shooting heroin. There's a developmental trajectory, and you can do a developmental analysis of that activity. And once you do that developmental analysis, then you can begin to figure out how it is that people get to be the way they are. And that's what Bronfenbrenner is about. You can figure it out, find out where it started, figure out what supported it, then you get the possibility of thinking about how to keep other people from doing that. If it's a behavior you don't like or that isn't socially valued, you can figure out how early can I intervene and keep kids out of the settings that will get that trajectory started. If I'm looking at a particular kid and I can see the setting being connected across time and the activities being ones that might lead in a direction that I don't like, then I can ask, how do I intervene? What settings can I make not possible for this kid? How can I divert this kid into other settings that will support a more positive set of activities? In other words, I'm asking, how can I bend a developmental trajectory? How can I keep it from going in the foreseeable direction and make it go in a different direction? That allows me to be an interventionist as a social worker, as a psychologist, as a police officer, whatever it is that I'm responsible for in the ecosystem, if I can look at it as a group of settings that support particular patterns of motivation and behavior, and I don't like some of those patterns of motivation and behavior, then I can figure out from the analysis where I might intervene and how. If I don't do that, if I don't have that kind of notion, then I do what social programs often do, which is do what makes sense, but it doesn't make developmental sense. You can't target. You don't have a way of looking at the development of the behaviors that you want to change. If you can look at them developmentally, then you can begin to see where to change. If you're thinking about the settings, you have an idea of where you can intervene. A couple of things about developmental trajectories are kind of fun. One is that as you're going along a developmental trajectory, you may be learning something in one setting that doesn't, you're really not aware that you're learning it. You're really not aware that you can do it, but it's a product of how you're developing in that particular setting from the microsystem that's in it. And you may not be aware of it until you move to the next setting, because you don't really have in the first setting, you don't really have an opportunity to play the role or to engage in the activity or have the kind of relationship that you can in the next setting, because there's a microsystem in the current setting that would be very difficult to change. But you may be learning things in that microsystem that will be useful in the next microsystem, in the next setting, because that one may give you an opportunity to play the role that you haven't been able to play before. You've seen it, you've got the activities, you know how to relate, but you don't really know how well you can do it until you move to a new setting and have new people and new expectations and new possibilities. So Rauschenbrenner says that we see sleeper effects. You may find out that you were exposed to something, you maybe learned it, but you didn't have much chance to really practice it, but you get into a new setting and it becomes possible and it shows up. And it may not even be the next setting. It may be the second or third one down the row that gives you the opportunity to engage in the role or the activity that you have figured out how to do. So, let me suggest a way that that becomes important for parents. What parents often see is the kid has been in predictable settings, and you've developed a set of expectations, you've assigned a role to the child, and you engage in relationships and activities with the child, and you're pretty comfortable with that. And the microsystem doesn't really allow the child to do anything particularly more responsible, or doesn't give an opportunity for the child to relate in a more mature and adult way. And then the fun thing about being a parent is sometimes your kids get into those settings and you don't really know what's going on in them because it's not a closed activity network. And you end up being invited to a performance of some kind or an opportunity to join the group temporarily. And you suddenly see your kid doing things that you've never seen your kid do before. They're consistent with what goes on at home, but they're at a much higher level of sophistication and competence. That's a sleeper effect. You weren't able to see it in the current microsystem, the one you and the kid were familiar with, because the opportunity wasn't there. But down the road, you see it. And you see the kid performing in ways that are much more mature and competent, because it's a different setting, because there are different opportunities there. That's a sleeper effect. It doesn't mean the new setting has been wonderful for him all by itself. It means that you did a good job and the kid picked up things that can be applied in a new setting. But it doesn't take away the notion of trajectory, because it links the settings, says that the earlier support for the behavior, even though it wasn't being demonstrated, the behavior wasn't being demonstrated, that earlier support was important developmentally because it allowed the kid to build the skills that were going to be, and the view of the world, that were going to be helpful in that next challenging environment. The notion of trajectory is a way for parents to take responsibility and credit for the good things that their kids do 10 years down the road. And that's a good thing. As a parent, I like being able to take credit for what my kids do. Well, for supporting their developmental trajectory. But it also keeps you humble about the fact that the kid is taking advantage of an environment that you may never have put it in. Oh, okay, somebody else might have made that setting possible, or encouraged the kid to join that group, or become engaged in that activity. Okay, so you don't get all the credit, because you're not directing all of the settings. But if you're supporting a developmental trajectory, you get some of the credit. Everybody along the trajectory gets some of the developmental credit. This hypothesis again refers to the settings across time and the possibility of developing trajectories, and it builds on the notion of trajectory to say that in order to do that trajectory, in order to follow that trajectory, the settings have to be available to you. And if you don't have the settings available to you, then your development is going to go in a different direction. Why would a setting not be available? Why would it not be open? This gets us back to Bronfenbrenner's notions of social address. Yeah. The characteristics of your family, ethnic characteristics, race, intelligence, education, socioeconomic status, all of those he calls social addresses that are often linked to developmental outcomes, but they don't directly explain the developmental outcomes. Why do kids from poor socioeconomic backgrounds do less well in school? Well, it's not because they're poor alone. Why do people who suffer from racism because they're African American, why are their developmental outcomes often less good than we would like? But it's not just because they're black. It's not built into being African American. Subtle difference I'm working on here. The subtle difference. It's not because you're poor. It's not because you're African American. It's not because you're female. It's not because you're male. It's not because you're from the Midwest or any of those other things. It's because those characteristics affect the developmental trajectories that are open to you and not open to you. So racism and sexism and classism operate by closing settings to you. You can't go in them. You can't go in this setting because you're black. You can't go in this setting because you're poor. Because you're in the Midwest, this setting will never be available to you. Because your parents are poor, you can't do this. So from a developmental perspective, the social addresses by themselves don't cause anything. But what they do is define the settings and the activities and the relationships that you can engage in and what developmental trajectories are open to you. On my desk right now, the book I'm reading at home is Vernon Can Read. Any of you read Vernon Can Read? Fun book. You probably don't know who Vernon is. Vernon Jordan, an African-American lawyer in Washington, D.C. Probably, arguably, the most powerful African-American attorney in the world. Close friend of and golfing partner with Bill Clinton and other people. Confidant of political figures, and he happens to be African-American. He happens to be very funny. He's also extremely bright. The title of the book, Vernon Can Read, is taken from a statement that was made by a powerful man in a small town in the South that Vernon grew up in, who was very surprised that as an African-American kid growing up in the segregated South, Vernon had actually learned to read. And what Vernon had done, because of characteristics of his family, aside from being African-American, they also were intelligent, well-educated, and lots of other things. What Vernon had done was have a series of settings open to him, including going to an Ivy League college. And those settings were open, but when he was working in the summer, he was working serving white people who were very surprised that he could read, because they assumed that if you were black, you didn't have any of those settings open to you. And in fact, it used to be illegal to teach blacks to read. It was illegal to teach slaves to read, because that would open opportunities for them that you didn't want to have open. And segregation in the South kept people out of settings where they could engage in activities that might, in fact, lead them in directions. Vernon got settings opened to him and carried out a developmental trajectory that's wonderful to read about. And if you grew up in the segregated South in the 50s, you understand what a triumph it was for him to be able to get into that developmental trajectory. What I'm reading the book for is to find out how that happened. It's clearly a developmental trajectory. And he's describing, he hasn't read Bronfenbrenner, strange, but he's describing how the settings got open to him and what the relationships were that supported his movement from setting to setting along a developmental trajectory. And your friends and mine are telling me that I need to stop. They're doing a good job of that. So, you're going to talk? She doesn't have much to say, but she's going to talk anyway.
All right.